The following is a paid program on AM 1220 KLBB. The views expressed do not necessarily represent the views of the station owner or management or Endurance Broadcasting, LLC.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Boating with Wolf Marine and Tetzloff Yacht Sales. We are a show dedicated to boating and marinas, actually with Wolf Marine and Tetzloff Yacht Sales. And my name is John Tetzloff. I'm with Tetzloff Yacht Sales. I'm right downtown Stillwater at 575 Main Street North. We sell and list used houseboats, cruisers, yachts. Basically, if it floats, we're going to try to help you out, find your boat, or sell it for you. You can check out our website at TetzloffYachtSales.com. You can contact me or us at 651-214-9463. And on my starboard side is...
I am Eric Wolf. I am the co-owner of Wolf Marine. We are a family-run and operated marina on the St. Croix River. We're located 1 mile north of downtown Stillwater in the intersection of Highway 95 and 96 on the St. Croix River, mile marker 24.5. You can reach us at area code 651-439-2341 or check us out on the web, wolfmarine.net. Email address is info@wolfmarine.net. And I would like to welcome a very special guest. He is the director of the St. Croix Watershed Research Station. This is Jim Allmendinger. Jim, welcome to our show.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Tell us a little bit about the St. Croix Watershed Research Station.
Well, it's kind of a rare thing. We are a private nonprofit research institute. And we're a part of the Science Museum of Minnesota, also a private nonprofit institute. We're not a state agency, per se. We have been at our marine location since 1989. That's when the research station was established. They raised the money to build it and buy the land all privately, some fairly large donations. And the research station is built, the laboratory is built in 1994 and opened up in 95 there. And I got there in late 1995. A colleague of mine, Dan Engstrom, was there as senior scientist in early 1995. And we've been there ever since, so 22 years at the same place, trying to look at the water and see how land impacts that.
Yeah, that's fantastic. What is, let's say, one of the main purposes of the research station?
Well, our mission is to understand, to try to find solutions to problems of environmental interest at the watershed scale, both in the St. Croix, but also in places worldwide. We're located in the St. Croix, but we're not limited to working there. We really get funding from a number of state and federal agencies, and we go wherever, you know, we can get funding to go and wherever the projects take us. We've had projects a lot in the St. Croix. That's our backyard, and we care a lot about that, and that we take care of that. But a lot of projects across the state, into Alaska, into Florida, into some of the Maritimes, and one at least far enough away, all the way to Mongolia, which is almost directly across the 180 degrees from our lines of longitude here. So it was a nice getaway for a couple summers.
Pretty amazing.
Pretty different.
Yep,
so.
Yep. And when you say marine, you mean marine on the St. Croix. That's where the station is located.
Yes, marine on St. Croix. We're not marine like in the ocean, although sometimes we would like to head out to tropical conditions from time to time.
Beautiful area up there, just like everything on the St. Croix. Just so fantastic. Yeah. So how did you become interested in science and natural history?
Oh, boy. That goes back to growing up in mid-Ohio, in the middle of cornfields and blue-collar factory towns. And the biggest town we got to was Chicago, where my great-grandmother lived. We would go up there, and we would visit the Field Museum and the Museum of Science and Industry. And I remember leaning over all the dioramas in the Field Museum, just wishing I could be part of it. And gradually, we became interested in natural history and environmental studies. My brother and I both left Ohio to come to Minnesota for graduate work in ecology. He became a forest ecologist, and I kind of deviated into hydrology. And in the late 80s, at least, my colleague from graduate school, then Dan Engstrom, the former director of the station, who is still there half-time. Dan had a project in Glacier Bay, Alaska, and I remember he asked me to join him for a couple of years up there. And so we were out in an 18-foot skiff with icebergs calving around us and orcas, you know, breaking the surface and humpback whales flipping their flippers up at us, and realized I was finally in one of those dioramas. I finally got to live this dream of looking inside and seeing and being in a really exciting environment like Glacier Bay and elsewhere. So that's science got me interested in traveling and seeing sights like that, and I had the aptitude, the detail-oriented nature in order to become a scientist, so it all fit together.
That's an amazing story. What are some of the your pet projects maybe to that are around here, the St. Croix? What are you trying to accomplish here?
Well, in the St. Croix, we used one of our main tools, and that is we looked at lake sediments. Now, Dan and I both came out of the University of Minnesota, where we looked at lakes to look at environmental histories, and we took that skill here and applied it to Lake St. Croix. Had a great graduate student, Laura Triplett, who is now a professor down at Gustavus Adolphus, and we took 24 cores, 8 transects of 3 cores each up and down the lake to get an idea of the sedimentation rate in the lake, and we looked at the chronology of the information in that sediment, because sediments, if you think about it, they're young at the top, and the lake lays down a layer every year, kind of like a tree ring.
Mm-hmm.
So when you core back into lake sediments, you're going back into time. And so we use some radiometric methods, like carbon-14, but it's a naturally occurring isotope called lead-210. And we have the ability to measure that in our laboratory, so we could use the lead-210 to measure how old the sediment was going back about 200 years, which is about the time of settlement or pre-settlement here. So we could go back in time in the lake sediment cores to see what the natural rates of sediment accumulation, and especially what the phosphorus loads were. Phosphorus is a nutrient, a plant nutrient that feeds algae. It is needed by all plants, but it's particularly sparse in the aquatic environment, in freshwater environment. And so when you add a little bit, it tends to go a long way. It tends to grow a lot of algae. So we wanted to see how that had changed over time. So we took the cores and measured how much was being sedimented out. We estimated how much is going down the stream. You can combine those two together to estimate how much phosphorus is getting into the St. Croix every year. And so we could do that over time, so we knew what the natural rates were, compare that with what was going on during the 90s, and which is when we started the study. So it gave us this baseline information and allowed us to compare today to the modern rates to see how far off we'd gone from the initial conditions.
Now we know the St. Croix is probably one of the cleanest rivers around here, and it's definitely my pride and joy. I've made my living off of it for my whole life, along with my family members. But the federal government has said that Lake St. Croix is impaired. What does that really mean?
Well, what it means is it is, but it's not very much impaired compared to most. I mean, compared to a lot of other river systems in the upper Midwest, it's one of the cleanest. What it means is that it's exceeded the limit that they've decided is really what they would like to see it at for what's fishable, swimmable, and drinkable. So for the uses that we would like to have for it, recreation included, it's just a little bit over the line. I know there are worse places in the world to clean up, but we thought there's no reason not to clean up the St. Croix as best we can and to keep it as clean as we can. Even if we don't get it to be, it'll never be perfectly clean again. It's not going to go back to pristine conditions because we're living here and impacting the environment. But we'd like to get it back to a point where its ecology is maybe back to something that's a little less impacted. The core studies we had done showed that in the 1940s, the algae had switched from being benthic, which are those that are growing on the bottom, which imply clear water conditions, and they became dominated by the planktonic forms of algae, which float in the water. And those are really fed by the nutrients coming off the land. And when they float in the water, then they shade out the diatoms and the algae growing on the bottom. Diatoms are a form of algae. So we knew if we could get the nutrient conditions back to what they were like in the 1940s, we might be able to switch the lake back to being a little more clear and flip this dominance of algae from the planktonic dwellers to the bottom-dwelling types, and that might help clean up the lake and change its ecology. So it certainly would help it from turning into these blue-green algal blooms, which everybody doesn't like because they're smelly and noxious, and they can be toxic. So we want to definitely avoid those. So that was our goal, and that gave us something to shoot for. And so they called it impaired because, well, it did exceed the standards, but at least we had a goal that we think was achievable. We can reduce the nutrients back about 20-25% from what they were in the 90s back to what they were in the 1940s, more or less. We should be able to achieve this cleaner state that the lake was formerly in. We're not going to go back, like I say, to pre-settlement times. That's not the goal. The goal is to make it clean enough so we don't have blue-green algal blooms and to get the water a little more clear.
And how has it rebounded since the 90s when you guys started to identify what needed to be done?
Well, I wouldn't say it's rebounded a lot. I mean, I think it's been pretty steady state. I mean, there are nutrient measurements going back in the river about 40 years. And the phosphorus levels have declined a little bit. But they go up and down, and they certainly go up and down with changes in land use. It's driven by row crop agriculture is the majority of the phosphorus getting into the water now, and it's not anybody's fault. That's just the way agriculture is nowadays. That's what we pay farmers to grow. But when corn prices get high, then more land gets put into corn, and then we have more trouble, more difficulty keeping the nutrients out of the water.
But there is a positive. There is a little uptick. There is a little uptick from what it was.
I think so.
Okay.
I think so.
We like to hear that. So what can we do? How can we fix that as just ordinary citizens or farmers or whatever?
Well, the first thing, you need to vote for the right people, people who care about this and will put it into policy. I mean, the biggest fix, I mean, it's something individual citizens can't do other than vote, is to try to change policies that promote the row crop agriculture over other forms of agriculture that might be more environmentally friendly. We need more perennials in the landscape, basically more cover crops. We need ways of paying farmers that will make those cover crops and perennial crops economically viable to them.
Yeah, there has to be a fine line between financial gain and environmental, stewardship.
Well, everybody wants to be an environmental steward, and everybody needs to make a living too.
Yes.
And we always got to try to balance those things, and it's tough. It's tough sometimes.
It is. Being a business owner that has a business on the St. Croix,
I know.
There's that fine line where, I have to make a living. One of our previous guests had also said, we are using internal combustion engines, so we can't consider ourselves environmentalists. I consider myself environmental friendly because I do what I can do, but there's still only so much that I'm able to afford to do. I'd love to do everything I could, but it costs money to do that also, and in many cases I can't afford to do some of the things that I wished I could do to help things.
Oh, I know. Everybody has an impact, and nobody intends to cause environmental problems. Nobody. So we're all part of the problem, and I guess we all try to have to be part of the solution.
And talking about Lake St. Croix, how is that? Why is that there? I know we were talking 10,000 years ago, the drainage of the big lakes and everything. Why is it there?
Well, it goes back a billion years. Oh. If you want to go a long ways back, and it's a lot of zeros after that one there. But there's this mid-continent rift that opened up under Lake Superior and split up even to the south, extending this far south. So it's been a low spot in the earth for a long time. It was covered over by inland seas for hundreds of millions of years ago that laid down all the sandstones and the limestones that build up the bedrock around here. The river has cut down through that, of course, and so we've got this bedrock trench out there called the St. Croix that is a beautiful, nice, deeply incised river. It was, of course, a river for, I think, a long time. The glaciers came and filled it up and filled up the valley with the sands and gravels, and then when they receded back into the Lake Superior Basin, the water flowing out of Lake Superior, all the sediment had settled out in the lake. There was a proglacial lake, and then the clean water that spilled out of the lake came right down the Brule River and down the modern St. Croix, along with, I think it also came out through the St. Louis River in by Duluth. So that all drained south, flushed out all the sands and gravels, and created a river. And then when the waters from the ice ended up draining out the St. Lawrence Seaway, they stopped coming down the St. Croix, at least as the meltwaters did, then the flows became much, much less. Then all the way down southern end of Lake Pepin, where the Chippewa River enters the Mississippi, all the sediment from the Chippewa built up. They no longer had the flow to keep flushing it out. So the Chippewa River dammed up the Mississippi at Lake Pepin, and the waters backed all the way up to St. Paul, and also backed up all the way into the St. Croix. So that was about 10,300 years ago, something like that.
So I was just trying to show off my knowledge of my glacial Lake Warren and Agassiz.
That was good, yeah.
And that had nothing to do with the St. Croix then.
Oh, yes, it
or did.
Yes, it did, because that was the Mississippi-Minnesota drainage, and that was, of course, where the St. Croix fed into, And that was all that the drainage of those, Glacier Lake Agassiz and Glacier Lake Duluth, were all related together with the massive flows down.
I feel better.
Yeah.
I feel a little better.
You should be. Well, you're better than most. I know almost anybody, but nobody else knows about Lake Warren or Glacier River Warren and Agassiz.
Yeah.
So
Good
for you.
Pretty cool stuff. You had some question there?
No, I was thinking here, it looks like we might be coming up to a break time here, so I think we should stay tuned here. We will be back with more of Jim Allmendinger and the St. Croix Watershed Research Station. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is John Tetzloff of Tetzloff Yacht Sales. If you are thinking of getting out on the water in your new boat, now is the time to talk to me. Whether you're looking at a houseboat, cruiser, motor yacht, or something else. And with the largest selection of boats in the area, not only do we have boats in Stillwater, but we also broker boats up and down the St. Croix, the Mississippi, Lake Minnetonka, all over North America, and even overseas. I will help you find the best boat for you. And because my name is the name on the sign, I will work hard for you before and after the sale. Come visit TetzloffYachtSales.com.
A convenient location in Protected Bay. Shouldn't that be where you harbor your boat? If so, dock your boat at Wolf Marine in Stillwater. Hello, this is Eric Wolf. After all, why have a boat if you can't get out onto the water and enjoy it? My grandparents, along with my father, established this marina at the intersection of Highway 95 and 96, just a mile north of Stillwater in 1957. But being just north of downtown, you avoid heavy traffic that keeps you from getting out onto the water. And in our protected bay, we have hundreds of slips ranging in size from 16 to 50 feet, so we can accommodate a variety of boats. Not sure if this is the best place to keep your boat? Come see me. I can answer your questions so you can decide the best place to dock your boat. And because Wolf Marine is a three-generation family-owned marina, you can count on consistency from year to year. Talk to me and get out on the water faster at Wolf Marine. Welcome back to Boating with Wolf Marine and Tetzloff Yacht Sales. I am Eric Wolf. I am the co-owner of Wolf Marine. We are a marina on the St. Croix River offering slips to boaters from slip sizes from 16 to 50 foot. If you have a boat looking for a place to keep it on the St. Croix, we are the place. Give us a call, 651-439-2341. And over to my port side, I have,
as usual, John Tetzloff with Tetzloff Yacht Sales, TetzloffYachtSales.com. Cell phone, actually the number to contact us is 651-214-9463. We're at 575 Main Street North, right downtown Stillwater, right next to the bike path. And Eric was talking about slips, and pretty soon even Culligan won't be able to soften up the water in the marina. It's going to be real hard.
It's hard already, yes.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, there's a lot of ice out there.
Okay, all right. Well, we want to welcome back Jim Allmendinger. He's the director of the St. Croix Watershed Research Station in Marine on the St. Croix, just north of Stillwater here. Beautiful area up there. Thanks for coming in, Jim, and welcome back.
I'm glad to be here.
Great. You know, I used to canoe back in the day. I think I started canoeing the Upper St. Croix when I was 14 years old with a buddy, and we probably did it twice a year. We'd go up to, I think it's called Gordon's Dam.
That's right. Yeah.
And we would throw in there, and the parents would drop us off, and we'd canoe down, and when we were done, they'd come get us, and we'd take 2 weeks to canoe that river. It was so beautiful up there. Sometimes it was a little low, so we had to get out and drag the canoe, which we hated to do. But, you know, I'd give anything to be able to get up there and drag a canoe on the Upper St. Croix again, because that was a ball. And great memories that I'll never forget. So real quick, where does the St. Croix start?
It starts up in a place near Solon Springs, Wisconsin, Upper St. Croix Lake. That's the headwaters. Now, the little stream that feeds that lake is actually coming out of a little wetland to the north of it. That's an interesting wetland because you think of wetlands as being low spots and water draining into them, and they do. However, this wetland drains not only to the south into the St. Croix, it also drains north into the Brule River, the Bois Brule River, and that flows north into Lake Superior. So that wetland is on a watershed divide, a continental divide, that divides water between going north to the Superior and the St. Lawrence Seaway, and the water going south to all the way through the Mississippi down to the Gulf of Mexico.
That's something that I never knew about. That's pretty amazing.
I didn't know about the northern part of it or flowing into Lake Superior. Yep. That's pretty cool. I think I'll have to get up there someday and check that out. And my next question was, does it start as a bubbling brook or a lake? And you already said it's basically just a wetland.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Most people think of the lake probably as being the real origin, but I think of the wetland as being the origin.
And the dam up there, what is that? It's called Gordon's Dam. I forgot. Is that a city or is that just the name of the area?
You know, I'm not sure about that. I know there is a dam and there's a Gordon flowage, which is the lake, I think, behind it. But I don't know its origin or the reason it was there. Perhaps for logging, which a lot of these dams were put in at one time to maintain floatable river segments. So
okay, and I know the water at some point in the Upper St. Croix is clear versus what it is down here. What's the difference between the water up there and the water here?
Well, the water down here has more input from both urban and agricultural sources. I mean, so it's a little more turbid, a little more nutrient rich. The water up there is just coming basically off the landscape, groundwater, and a lot of water seeping out of wetlands. And the wetlands give it that brown tea color that comes out. That's nothing that to be afraid of. It's usually an indicator of pretty clean water. So it's really very good up there, the water quality, and it's mostly good down here. It's just, like I say, impaired a little bit above the standards we have for it.
Okay, and I know that when we used to canoe up there, we'd bring those little iodine. What'd you call it?
I think iodine tablets.
Iodine tablets. Okay.
Were common. Yeah.
So you can still scoop some water out, put it in a bucket, and put the tablets in there, and eventually drink that water.
Yeah, it shouldn't be a problem at all. Nowadays, people use usually hand pump filters to clean up their water for drinking when they go camping. That way, you don't have that chemical taste in the water.
Sure.
Many times when I had camped as a young child and a young adult, I guess I could say also, there are many streams springs that are coming right out of the ground, and we never even thought twice about it. That was good, clean, fresh water for us. When I can never remember getting sick from it for anything. So
yeah, I think the biggest problem there would be beaver impacts, and beaver
waste.
Can carry giardia.
Beaver fever.
Yeah. Right. And giardia is kept in it, the little cyst can be kept in suspension by turbulence. So
and that little bit of information from Eric may tell us a lot about
yeah.
about what was being questioned here.
It really didn't affect me.
All right. So
all this time you thought it was your cooking that was making you sick.
Or his brother or something. Yeah. But anyway. So how is the upper St. Croix water? Is that being affected much?
I say it's in great shape mostly. Up there, the biggest concerns right now are the pipeline that they're thinking about putting across some of the headwaters of the St. Croix. They want to put in, either an additional one or replace the old one. I can't remember what all the details are, but I know there is a concern about an oil pipeline going in there, Line 3 from Enbridge.
So. Now, that's a national park, or I think, doesn't NSP own a lot of the land up there?
I presume they do. I don't know, or Xcel nowadays.
Or Xcel, yeah.
The Riverway, the national park portion, is really just the river corridor itself. They're responsible for that. They have very few land holdings outside the immediate river corridor. They rely on state and federal agencies to keep the rest of the landscape clean, because the river depends on having a clean landscape if you want to have clean water.
Sure. So being the director of the St. Croix Watershed Research Station, I have to believe that you advise on many things.
We get asked in to be sort of expert advice to a number of things. It's not we do our best to fit that in. Mostly, we're what's known as a soft money institution, in that the scientists are paid by projects mm-hmm. that we get from state and federal agencies. Those projects often have policy implications. They teach, they help the legislators and the agencies make good management decisions. And then, yes, from time to time, they have committees get together. They want us to sit in on those and try to weigh in on what the best thing to do is. And we fit that in when we possibly can.
That's good.
Do you guys deal at all with the invasive species?
We're not so much on that mm-hmm. directly, not the initial ones. However, we just got a project funded through the LCCMR, the Legislative and Citizen Commission of Minnesota Resources, to look for an invasive algal species. There's a new algae moving up from the south. It's a toxic blue-green algae. Spermopsis?
Yeah, that's right. That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, so we just call it Cylindro because I can hardly pronounce it myself. So it's moving into the area. You want to see if it's been here before. We're going to look for toxins in the water and, again, use lake sediments to go back in time maybe and look for toxins in the lake sediment to see if we can see them there as well.
And how much has the river, going back to St. Croix, how much has it filled up in the last couple hundred years as far as from the bottom?
The sediment moving up? Yeah. Well, let's see. The last couple hundred years, I'm trying to think. It's got about triple the natural sedimentation rate now than it did back in pre-settlement times in the early 1800s. You know, in terms of volume loss, I'm trying to think of what the numbers were down on Lake Pepin, but I guess it's not as big a problem as it is in Lake Pepin. We certainly have more sediment getting into the river now than we used to, but as far as we know, it's not a major issue right now.
From what I've gathered, also Lake Pepin, the Minnesota River really has the major contribution to the settlement in Lake Pepin.
That's right. There's been a lot of sediment brought in from the Minnesota Basin. That's the breadbasket of Minnesota, of course. And it comes from both field erosion. That's part of it. But actually, surprisingly, in the Minnesota, a lot of the sediment's coming from bank erosion.
Okay.
So,
For the last couple years, few years, the water in the St. Croix has been way higher than what I've ever seen it in years past. Even in midsummer, July, we've had high water. What do you suppose causes this? What's going on here?
Well, I think we're just going through a phase of more rainfall. I mean, I've looked at the response times of hydrologic systems, and you know they're going to have a memory of the last 5 to 10 years of rainfalls. And if they've increased over that time, you're going to get a surge in water levels. It'll rise things up. It'll give you more stream flow for trout streams, more groundwater gain. It will and has lifted White Bear Lake and other things like that. So all these things rise and fall with a decadal type heartbeat.
Natural occurrence.
I think so, but it doesn't mean to say that it may have exceeded previous amounts. I don't know. As climate shifts a little bit here and there, we could be experiencing greater rainfalls.
Yeah.
I mean, and it may continue for the next. For our generation, I don't
sure.
know.
Yep.
Yeah, I think that's what I understand is that the global warming will create more rain in our area, if that's what I understand.
It's my understanding, too. Some of the models that I've looked at, the model results suggest that winters will get warmer and wetter, and that wetness will bring another increase of 10-15% rainfall to the area.
Okay, all right. Well, you know what? It looks like we're coming to the end of our show here. Not really, but we're going to just say that. I just made a mistake.
No, we're wrapping it up.
I looked at the clock wrong. I'm sorry.
We've got a few minutes.
We wanted to talk about a little bit about a couple of boats that I have for sale that I want to mention, and one is that Cruisers. I've had a couple of people look at it. It's that 2004 37-foot Cruisers with the diesel that the gentleman really wants to sell, so you guys need to get out there on the website and look at it. And I also have a Cottage Cruiser, which is a 50-foot skipper liner down in La Crosse. No propulsion whatsoever on that boat, so it's a true liveaboard. It's in great shape. It's a 2006. You would get on it and think it was brand new, so you need to check that boat out on the website too. And Eric?
Well, first, I've got questions, hey?
Oh.
don't just pass it off to me. So this boat you were just talking about,
sure.
What's the size of it?
The liveaboard is a 50 by 14.
Okay.
And it's basically a home on the water. It doesn't have any propulsion, like I said.
Yep.
He keeps it down in La Crosse, and the life has changed for him, and he just wants to sell it. He bought it new, but the boat is beautiful. It's got a lot of living area, heat and air. But again, no propulsion, although it was made for an outboard to be put on it.
Sure. So it could be retrofitted with an outboard to move it anyhow. So
what about that pizza and ice cream pontoon that you're selling?
Yeah, that's still for sale right next to my office, right on 95 there. Right.
Jenna and I are thinking about buying that.
Well, I think we need to talk after the show because the owner is very anxious to sell that.
I love that.
And,
that's a nice... Yeah,
he used it on Gull Lake and sold ice cream and hot dogs, and he actually brought it to fairs. Because it does have the trailer.
Right, okay.
So, it's kind of a cool-looking...
Yeah, it's very cool. Yeah.
Absolutely. And once you do buy these boats from John, I know a place to keep them.
Where would that be?
I have a great place just 1 mile north of downtown Stillwater, and it's just right off the walking path that goes right by John's office. So we have a great walking path from our place right to downtown Stillwater. So, we're 1 mile north of downtown Stillwater, intersection of Highway 95 and 96. And, yes, we do have slips ranging in size from 16 to 50 foot. So that 50-footer would fit right in one of our slips. Be a great place to keep it. We're quiet, peaceful, family-orientated. We'd love to have that boat there. And then the other boat also, the food boat, I'd love to see that up there because, you know what, I wouldn't have to go far for lunch
right.
there.
That's right. Just walk out in the dock and order it up.
That's right.
So, again, thanks to Jim Almendinger from the – he is the director of the St. Croix Research – St. Croix Watershed Research Station. I can't talk very good. We really appreciate you coming
in. Thanks for having me. It's great to meet you guys.
Thanks for coming.
See you guys. Okay.